This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is George Packer, whose latest book is titled The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. He's also the author of The Assassin's Gate. There are four nonfiction books, two novels, one play, and I guess you're a staff writer for The New Yorker as well?
Yes, since 2003.
The Unwinding concerns the last 40 years of America from various perspectives, a symphony of voices, as you call it. Can you talk about what prompted you to start the book and also its relationship to the USA trilogy by John Dos Passos?
The book is it's a generation-long saga about America. It's a portrait of the country over the last generation. I think something changed around the late 70s that created a new era, the one that we are still in. And to put it very simply, the social contract began to come apart, and it's been coming apart ever since in more and more visible ways. Lots of institutions have stopped functioning very well, from government to business to the media to schools. And this is a big story, and I wanted to find a way to tell it in an immediate and gripping way, not as a political book or a policy book or even a history in the sense of big events. Instead, I wanted to convey the feel of this period and what it's like to be an American living today and how this state of affairs we're in now came about. And to do that, I needed to tell stories and to find a structure to put them in. So the book moves through 35 years from 1978 to the present of American history through the lives of a handful of people who the reader hasn't heard of, and also sketches of the leading figures of the period from different walks of life. From politics, there's Newt Gingrich and there's Elizabeth Warren. From entertainment, there's Oprah and there's Jay-Z. From business, there's Sam Walton. There's Alice Waters from the town that we're in right now. So you see America from both the point of view of elites and the point of view of ordinary folks, from powerful places like Washington, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and also forgotten places like Youngstown, Ohio, and rural North Carolina. To put it all together, I needed a structure that could contain this disparate array of American voices and characters. And I turned to Dos Passos' great trilogy, USA, from the 30s, because it provided me in fiction a model for this nonfiction. Three decades of American life at the beginning of the 20th century, following the stories of his characters who are caught up in the history of their times, which is also what happens to the characters in my book, and whose destinies are sort of cast into light by the stories of the leading figures from that period, from Henry Ford to Woodrow Wilson. So that became a model, although, of course, I had to depart from it because this is not a novel. This is all true.
What made you select these five? I don't want to call them people because they're four people and one city. Yeah. Okay, you have this idea, and I understand Dean Price was the first person that you put in. When you interviewed him, I guess it was for The New Yorker, was this beginning to arise?
I already knew I wanted to write a book about the era that led to the financial crisis and Obama's election. Those were the two events that gave me the idea for this book. Although it really goes back to the Iraq War and the failure of one institution after another to rebuild and bring that country out of its ruins. So I had begun to think about American institutions failing before 2008. 2008 was a historic year for institutions collapsing. Dean Price crossed my path when I was doing a piece for The New Yorker about Obama's first year, and it focused on a congressman from Virginia named Tom Perriello, who was elected by a whisker in a very red district in Southern Virginia. He's a Democrat. It was kind of an amazing win for him. His office connected me to various people in that district who had alternative energy projects that he was trying to get grants from the stimulus bill for. And one of them was Dean Price, who actually is not a Virginian. He's a North Carolinian. He's from the tobacco and textile country of the Piedmont, which is sort of around Greensboro, Winston-Salem. He played a very small part in that New Yorker piece, but he stayed in my head because his voice was so original and compelling and deeply American. So over the next couple of years, I just kept going down to North Carolina, staying at his house on a little rural highway just down the hill from one of his truck stops, and began to get to know Dean Price through the tool of immersion journalism.
Well, what he is one element of America, which is the entrepreneur and also the green element taken care of in this one place. And then if you're looking at politics, you know, we have the story of Jeff Connaughton, who spent some time as a Biden aide, also as a lobbyist. How did you run across him, and when did he join the pack?
I interviewed him for a story I was doing on insider trading, a trial in Wall Street. And he was a good source because his last government job was working for Ted Kaufman of Delaware, who replaced Biden in the Senate in 2009. And Kaufman and his chief of staff, Jeff Connaughton, made it their mission over a very short 2-year period to both punish Wall Street with draconian reforms for the financial crisis and to expose individuals on Wall Street to prosecution for the wrongdoings that led to the financial crisis. And needless to say, in neither of those missions were they successful. But along the way, I got to know Connaughton, and his story fit perfectly with the terms of my book. His career spanned the 35 years of the book from the late 70s. So all the characters are of a certain generational cohort, born in the late 50s or the 60s. He went to Washington as a young idealist who wanted both to change the world for the better and to attach his ambitions to Joe Biden. He thought Joe Biden was going to get him to the White House in the 80s. That did not happen either. He then became a lobbyist because government service didn't really work for him. Biden turned out not to be a very nurturing boss. Lobbying was hugely successful for Connaughton. He made a fortune. He then lost a lot of it in the financial crisis, and he went back into government in a sense to punish the banks. That story captured Washington during that period, the swamping of government by money that has been the story, I think the main story of Washington over the last generation. Connaughton's life embodied that story, and his point of view, which is scathing and candid, gave me a critical eye on it. And he was someone who could tell me where the bodies were buried, and he was willing to, which is really almost unheard of in Washington because no one wants to disqualify themselves permanently from admission into the establishment. Washington is full of these guys, number two guys, who are essential to the success of the number ones, but we never hear about them. But they're a really big part of the Washington story.
George Packer, I guess the next one to come on the list, was it Tammy Thomas, who was an African-American activist?
Well, she was actually the last one, okay. But we should talk about her because I think she's, along with Dean Price, the most important figure in the book. This was toward the end of the reporting, which was really sometime early last year. I realized I wanted to have a woman character. I needed to have one. I wanted to have someone from the Rust Belt, because if you look at the undoing of the deal that held Americans together in the post-war period. Deindustrialization is an essential part of that. Tammy Thomas is a black woman from Youngstown, Ohio, which was a steel town. It had nothing but steel. That was what supported the place. And she was the daughter of a heroin addict, and she essentially took care of her mother as she was growing up rather than vice versa. She then had three kids very young, no one to support them but herself, and she managed to do it by getting one of the last good factory jobs after the steel mills collapsed in very rapid succession in the late 70s, early 80s. She went to work at a GM auto parts factory and for 20 years kept her family alive and safe as Youngstown collapsed around her and her old neighborhoods and her friends and her classmates. Many of them fell by the wayside. She survived because she had this job, and then the job disappeared right before she was going to get her pension because the company did what many companies do now and declared a kind of tactical bankruptcy to get out of its contracts with its American workers and to ship the jobs to Mexico. She remade herself in midlife as a community organizer, and that's what she does today.
How did you find her?
I started asking people in the Midwest or people who were experts on the Midwest, do you know a woman in the Rust Belt who's doing some interesting work in trying to revive an old industrial city? I mean, a kind of crazy question to ask, but I started getting names and looked into them, and she interested me most because she wasn't just an activist. She was a factory worker who became an activist.
There are two other stories to tell. One is another person, Peter Thiel, who's a libertarian Silicon Valley entrepreneur. How did you come to him and the decision to use Silicon Valley, someone in Silicon Valley, as emblematic?
In a way, the book is a study of winning and losing. And I think one characteristic of this period I call the unwinding is that winners now win bigger than ever, and losers fall farther than ever, and there's less to support the fall than perhaps since the 1920s. I needed to see the most successful examples of American life from this period, and you have to say that the two sectors that have done well while the rest of the economy was stagnating are Wall Street and Silicon Valley. And one of the features of the unwinding of this period is the information age. It coincided with the unwinding, with the collapse of manufacturing and of other institutions. Peter Thiel interested me because, first of all, his politics are very different from mine. I wanted to kind of bounce my ideas off a conservative. He's brilliant. He founded PayPal. He made his big money through Facebook. He was the first outside investor. So he's this brilliant tech investor who had become a critic of tech. I read things he was writing that said maybe the internet has been overhyped. And so I wanted to hear what he had to say about that. And I wrote a profile of him for The New Yorker, which was done entirely in order to be able to write about him for my book. So his story is this, partly the story of the incredible success of Silicon Valley, but it's also the story of how the technology revolution did not raise living standards around the country as earlier revolutions like the assembly line did. And Peter Thiel is an unusual person in the Valley in that he's able to see that and to articulate how dazzling change in the way we live does not necessarily mean progress. And that's an important theme in The Unwinding. So his story gave me a very key element of both shining success and also kind of the hollowness that was just beneath it.
Now we come to the final tale, which I guess you were still looking around for individuals and you didn't find one. Is that what happened? And you somehow knew that the other story had to be about housing? Is that what it was?
The housing bubble and bust were symptomatic of so many things that had gone wrong. The fact that our economy needed these constant bubbles, whether it's stocks, bonds, dot-coms, or housing, it suggested something isn't working here. There's no solid foundation to growth. We no longer have an engine for growth. So everyone chases these little chimeras and inflates them, and then they pop, and then we go looking for another one. Tampa, Florida was one of a handful of ground zeros of the housing bust. It became a place where people making in the mid five figures, modest, you know, to middle class incomes, really middle class incomes, would own five or six houses at a time, flipping them constantly as investment properties. Housing became an investment commodity, a disposable commodity. And Tampa's growth, which was not in the city but in the county around it, subdivisions springing up on wiregrass and swamp where there was no infrastructure, and the infrastructure had to follow. And some developer's idea of a community sprang up overnight, and before it could even be finished, before the roads were all paved, before the houses were there to match, to meet the driveway that had been paved up to the house, it all stopped. The music just stopped almost at a certain instant, and it all began to fall. So I started going to Tampa. I went there quite a few times and never found that one person who gives me a way into these other aspects of the unwinding. But I did find this situation of sort of a life of instant things and of getting in over your head, of having too much debt and too big a house and then having it all fall apart and then picking up the pieces, because foreclosures were an epidemic in Tampa.
You're listening to an interview with George Packer, whose latest book is titled The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. What areas would you have liked to have more of focus? Maybe the national media, something like that?
I had to choose, obviously, because you can't throw your arms around America and grab it. It's too big. And it depended on finding the right people. I mean, if these individual stories were not compelling, if I didn't capture their voices, because this is what this book is, it's in the third person, but it really is told through the point of view and the voices of these characters and in their diction, their rhythms of speech, the metaphors they use. If those weren't compelling, this would be a disaster. This would be like an epic failure of ambition, of overambition, which I hope it isn't. To tie it together, I needed both a chronology, and you move back and forth among these five through time, beginning in the late 70s and coming up to the present, and also thematically. It really is about how institutions that used to support ordinary people's ambitions and dreams started failing and were replaced by a culture of elites who have replaced the institutions or now run them or fund them or have swept them aside, you know, for their own purposes. So there are these profiles in the book of 10 leading Americans from the period to see the gap between our elites and ordinary people, and to see how the people who the elites who led these institutions presided over their breakdowns.
You save your anger, I guess your greatest anger, for even more than Newt Gingrich, for Robert Rubin and the late Andrew Breitbart.
And you know, I've heard that the Rubin profile is the most devastating. I wasn't quite aware of that as I wrote it, but what I've done in these profiles, as with the main characters, I've taken the words of these figures to tell their story. Most of them wrote autobiographies. Robert Rubin's autobiography is a portrait of a modest man who kept finding himself unexpectedly in more and more powerful positions, and through a kind of disinterested, rational approach to evidence, came up with what he thought were the best policies on both Wall Street and in the Clinton administration. And I have some admiration for Robert Rubin. I think he's a decent man and had very good intentions, but he was part of institutions, especially Wall Street, that were going rotten, and he didn't see that. He imagined that Wall Street's interests and America's converged, And in 2008, when he was at Citigroup making $15 million a year and doing very little for it, suddenly Wall Street was not just different from the national interest. It was directly counter to it. And so in a way, his story shows that even sort of the most admirable figures from these institutions, if they didn't see what was wrong, got swept up in the rottenness. And I think that happened to Robert Rubin, especially in the last years he was at Citigroup. You mentioned Breitbart, Andrew Breitbart, the late internet provocateur. He's in the book because to me he represents exactly the kind of person who succeeds when institutions fail. In his case, the media failed. He was a kind of bomb-throwing right-wing demagogue who used the internet early and very well, not just to push his right-wing agenda, but to spook the mainstream media. His entire career was about making reporters feel like they weren't doing their jobs doing them well.
Did you know him at all?
I met him in an elevator once, and he seemed like a very nice, charming Irishman. He's from L.A. You know, he's a creature of TV, Hollywood, and kind of the 80s and a pretty nice, comfortable American life. You always felt with him that it was sort of a game. None of it was really all that serious. When he was asked about healthcare, he said, "How do I know? I don't know anything about healthcare. I'm just here to make noise and to spook the media." And he did, because during these years, the New York Times and CBS and other great institutions, you know, would commit little errors like the Jason Blair fabrications or the Dan Rather documents on 60 Minutes and produce such a backlash both on the right and among sort of the new internet voices that they kind of lost faith in what they did and kept questioning themselves and stopped doing it in some cases. The TV news networks stopped being news networks. The news magazines stopped being news magazines. The New York Times, I would say, remained true to its mission, but there are very few great news organizations left in this country. So this sort of devastated landscape was wide open to, you know, a charming rogue like Andrew Breitbart to walk in and use the internet to say, there's no more objectivity. There's no more facts. There's just noise and narrative. And that's unfortunately what a lot of young people who don't have faith in the mainstream media for some good reasons and some bad, or who grew up on the internet, that seems to be a prevailing kind of postmodern attitude. And Breitbart, to me, you know, was a fun, colorful emblem of the collapse of that institution.
Does writing something like this radicalize you? How does it make you, George Packer, feel?
I became quite radicalized, not just by writing the book, by doing the reporting that led to the book. I mean, I'm a liberal. I'm a liberal in a very establishment magazine, The New Yorker. I've had a very comfortable life from Stanford University to Yale to some rough years in my 20s and early 30s, but to, you know, I can make a living as a writer, which is something that's very hard to say these days in America. And yet, you know, the past few years, I think, have been undeniable proof that we are becoming a plutocracy, a word I would have maybe rolled my eyes at 10 or 20 years ago. And we're becoming a plutocracy with a class that is becoming a hereditary class of leaders. Where you're born, who your parents are, and therefore where you go to school and where you go to college is going to determine the course of your life. And the idea of upward mobility is less and less viable for most people. We have these exceptions. Jay-Z, who's profiled in the book, is like the most dramatic rags-to-riches story in America.
Well, there's Oprah, too.
And Oprah is another. Those stories, I think, mislead us into imagining that the widening of opportunity is real. I think they are instead more like a casino where a few people get the ticket or win the jackpot and most people are left behind. So it was an infuriating thing to write this book. It was also a moving thing because especially Dean Price and Tammy Thomas got under my skin. I mean, I came to love these people and to feel their attachment, not just to their community, but to an idea of the country through them. Like, I really felt both anger toward America and a love of it, because I was writing about people who had not given up on the American dream. They're still invested in it. Whether it's invested in them is another question.
In an interview, you say the extremes in America are so great, but there's nothing holding it together at the center.
We used to have, and I don't want to romanticize the 50s, 60s, early 70s. There were many groups of Americans left out of the deal. But the circle had the capacity to widen itself. There were institutions capable of reform, and they did reform, so that by the 70s, more and more people were included in opportunity in America. What we've done is exchanged that social contract for freedom. We have more and more freedom and more choice, and the internet is just one example of that. But what holds it together? For example, in news, what are the facts that Americans can kind of agree on and then begin to argue about the right solutions or the right policies? There are none. Everyone has their own facts, and they have their own websites to support those facts. And instead of having Walter Cronkite telling you what was happening in Vietnam and actually commanding belief across the broad middle of the country, we now have a polarized landscape in which the truth is constantly contested. Now, that might seem like a good thing, because we should question the news and whether things that we hear are actually true. But I worry that we're entering this weird age where, you know, there's only what you read on Twitter, and who cares if it's true? It's someone's voice. We only have, you know, we now have a million voices. And to me, that's, it may be liberating for some people who did not have a mouthpiece before, but I don't think it's a healthy thing for a democracy, which requires some common ground in order to function.
Well, it also means the end of expertise, doesn't it? I mean, if all voices are equal?
It does. It does. And you can blame the media and other institutions for their failures, but it shouldn't give you pleasure to see them fail. I mean, in a way, that was Sarah Palin's point. She loved seeing the mainstream media make a fool of itself, because she didn't believe in expertise. She believed in the wisdom of ignorance. I don't think that's a good place from which our leaders should come, and I don't think it's a good place from which our citizens should come.
Is there any way that we as citizens can do anything other than be on our own, be our own Tammy Thomas, let's say?
Well, the hopefulness in the book, and I do think that the stories leave you with this encouragement that there are these individuals who, far from having given up, are still ardently pursuing a vision. It's very local. It's not happening in Washington. It's not happening in the media capitals. It's happening out of view in forgotten places. Whether all these separate efforts by people whose names we don't know will lead to some kind of coherent reform movement, like the progressive movement and the populist movement in a very similar time 100 years ago, that I don't know. I'm not a predictor of the future. The book does not prognosticate, nor does it prescribe. What I wanted to do was to portray, to give us a picture of America today, and to show how we've come to this point we're at now.
You've been listening to an interview with George Packer, whose latest book is The Unwinding. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. For more information about this show, go to bookwaves.com, where you'll also find an extended version of this interview. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
KBOO Community Radio and Veterans for Peace Chapter 72 are proud to co-sponsor a special presentation on Thursday, August 1st at 6:30 p.m. An insider's account of Guantanamo will examine the illegality immorality and inhumanity of the U.S. Naval Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, with Stephen T. Wax, Chief Federal Public Defender for the District of Oregon, Laura Sandown, a U.S. Navy veteran who served at Guantanamo, and S. Brian Wilson, a longtime peace activist, among others. An insider's account of Guantanamo will take place at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in downtown Portland. Thursday, August 1st, doors open at 6:30 p.m. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move you.